Former U.S. Representative Denny Rehberg says he will not run for his old seat in the U.S. House. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about new ice skating classes being held by the Helena Parks Department. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with one of the directors of the Mother's Milk Bank of Montana. Former U.S. Representative Denny Rehberg said today he has decided not to run for his old House seat or any other office in 2014. In a text message to the Missoulian, Rehberg said he wants to, quote, focus on family, friends, and business for a while, end quote. Although his name had not been mentioned for the House publicly, on January 2nd, Rehberg told reporters he had not ruled out running for the seat this year. After that, Rehberg said people began contacting him, asking he consider running for the seat. He said that he, his wife, and a relative have opened a Burger King in Billings that employs 43 people, and they hope to build three more across the state this year. Four Republicans and one Democrat already have announced they are running for the U.S. House seat. Two more Republicans have said they are likely to enter the race. And in other news from around the state, officials in northwestern Montana have identified the California skier who died when he fell into a tree well at Whitefish Mountain Resort over the weekend. Platte County Undersheriff Dave Lieb tells the Missoulian the victim was 54-year-old Douglas Spring. Lieb said he did not know Spring's hometown. Officials have said Spring and his son were skiing in an ungroomed forested area on the mountain's north side Saturday when Spring fell into a tree well. The son didn't realize his father wasn't with him until he reached the bottom of the run. He retraced their route and found his father's skis sticking out of the snow at the bottom of a tree. Efforts to resuscitate him failed. Spring is the third person to die after falling in a tree well at Whitefish Mountain since December of 2010. The weather system that moved into the region this weekend dumped a lot of snow in parts of western Montana's high country, but avalanche experts hope people give the snowpack time to settle. The West Central Montana Avalanche Center issued an avalanche warning that expired yesterday. The center's Steve Karkinen says that warning was based on snowfall in the Bitterroot, Rattlesnake, and Southern Swan and Mission Mountains.
A lot of the snowtell sites where we take a look at what the snowfall conditions are like, we're reporting approaching 3 inches of snow or equivalent, or close to 30 inches of snow in about a 48-hour period. Now, that in and of itself is an issue when it comes in on top of weak layers that we've been looking at throughout the season. But the main concern we had was the high wind speeds that came in over the weekend. We had places where winds were recorded close to 50 miles an hour for that two-day period, and that moved a lot of snow around onto the leeward slope. So we felt it would be prudent to issue a warning, and even today, Monday, we're still saying it's high avalanche danger. We're out today taking a look at a variety of different places in our area just to see what happened after that brutal snow and wind that we had.
Karkinen says a lot of the snowfall was rather warm and dense.
What we're really hoping happens is, you know, even though we've had a lot of new snow, that snow settles up quickly and the hazard, you know, begins to mellow out over the course of time. You know, we still think it's going to be dangerous for a few more days, but we really like to see more snow throughout the course of the winter, and the more snow we get, things tend to stabilize through, you know, just through time. But we're really watching what these winds are doing. We've had some pretty high winds for the last month now, and wind moves snow around into places where you might be surprised where you could find a wind slab that could be easily triggered by a skier or a snow machine.
An avalanche closed part of Highway 93 south of Lost Trail Pass this weekend, and Karkinen says there were several reports of natural slides, but no reports of any deaths or injuries. He urges people to check avalanche advisories before leaving for their adventure, talk with others who've been out there, and also to pay close attention to their surroundings.
There's a lot of people in this area that like to get after it, and that's generally the best source of information. And if they're seeing avalanche activity, you don't need to spend a lot of time looking at the snowpack. If there's recent avalanche activity, recent heavy snowfall, high winds, or you're seeing and hearing collapse noises in the snowpack, those are big red flags that the conditions are probably unstable. And then also during periods of rapid warming like we're seeing right now, you know, particularly at the, you know, the mid-range elevations up to, you know, between 5,000 and 8,000 feet, these warmer temperatures can produce instabilities in the snowpack. So it's a good time to be careful.
Visit MissoulaAvalanche.org for the latest snowpack information. A panel that will recommend a replacement for former Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris is taking applications from attorneys. The 7-member Judicial Nomination Commission says it will announce the names of the candidates after the application period ends February 12th. The application period will be followed by a 30-day public comment period on the applicants, after which the commission has a month to forward its recommendations to Governor Steve Bullock. Morris and former State District Judge Susan Waters resigned their positions last month to become U.S. District Court District Judges in Great Falls and Billings. The Nomination Commission previously announced it was accepting applications to replace Waters in the busy state court in Billings. Montana Supreme Court Justice Jim Rice says he supports judicial elections over appointments because elections force judges to be accountable for their decisions. Rice spoke today after filing for re-election with the Montana Secretary of State's office. He is seeking his third 8-year term after being appointed by Governor Judy Martz to fill a vacancy on the High Court in 2001. Rice says the state system of holding nonpartisan elections is good for judges. He says there can be, quote, a disconnect to accountability, end quote, in the federal judicial system because those judges are appointed. No opponent has yet filed to run against Rice in the 2014 election. Justice Mike Wheat has also said he will seek re-election. Elections are to be held for 9 district judgeships across the state. Montana State University issued a warning to students, faculty, and staff after a woman reported a man grabbed her arm in a dorm stairwell and threatened to rape her. KTVM-TV reports police were called to the Johnstone Center at 6:20 last night. The woman said she was able to run away from the suspect. She said he was a white man about 5'7" tall and was wearing a green hoodie. A Montana woman visiting family in southeast Texas has died after picking up a lamp from some wet ground and being electrocuted. The Galveston County Daily News reports the accident happened last night in Texas City. Fire Marshal Dennis Harris says the victim, whose name and hometown weren't immediately released, was barefoot in a wet yard. A table lamp being used outside was connected to an extension cord plugged into a socket inside the house. Harris says the woman was electrocuted when she touched the lamp. Inspectors after the accident found electrical work not up to code at the house that had several additions. Harris had electricity cut to the house following the accident. He says the wiring must meet code requirements before the power will be restored. A 2-vehicle crash on ICUS Highway 87 near Box Elder killed a 17-year-old Shawmut girl and injured a 30-year-old Haver woman. The Montana Highway Patrol says a girl was northbound about 6:15 last night when she lost control of her car and collided with an oncoming car in the southbound lane. The Great Falls Tribune reports both were taken to the hospital in Haver, where the girl was pronounced dead. The extent of the woman's injuries was not immediately available. Neither name has been released. The University of Montana expects to begin construction this spring on a new athletics academic center on campus. The Missoulian reports plans call for expanding the Adams Center westward by about 4,000 square feet and building a 3-story addition. The entrance will remain on the first level with the academic center on the second level. The basement will eventually include new locker rooms for visiting teams and performers. The $2.5 million facility will be paid for with private donations and will provide the university's 300 student-athletes with a convenient location for studying. Assistant Athletic Director for Internal Operations Chuck Mays says the center will give UM a strong recruiting tool and send a message to athletes that academics matter. The work is scheduled to be completed next year. A smooth, frozen pond sits in the middle of Helena, a skating rink for citizens' use at Memorial Park. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a new effort there to teach kids how to make their way around the ice.
A cluster of well-bundled kiddos is stomping their ice skates just outside the Memorial Park warming hut.
How you guys feeling? Good?
Good.
It's nighttime, the rink lit by overhead lamps, and 18-year-old Megan Williams,
a skating instructor.
She's their teacher.
Da-da-da.
Da-da-da.
It's the first time the Helena Parks Department has had ice skating lessons. The scene sort of looks like a winter version of swimming lessons, and Williams says, yeah, It's just that the water is a lot harder.
A lot harder, a lot colder, so you dress for the elements.
And it's a good thing everybody's dressing for the elements. All that padding comes in handy when the little students fall. Crashing to the slippery ice. Red light, green light. There's about one kid midair any given second. Head over heels, landing on their back, their sides. Watching parents don't seem to know whether to smile or gasp. I pull aside 10-year-old Caden after a particularly painful-looking tumble.
How many times do you think you've fallen tonight?
Probably like 20 or something.
Instructor Megan Williams, she says, well, it's a lot like life.
That you fall and you have to learn how to get back up.
She believes this so much that the very first thing she has them do...
All right, so now we're going to practice falling down.
Her 10 everybody students kind of go,
Everybody fall down.
Okay.
Hi.
And all right. Flop over.
All right, everybody back up.
She has the kids waddling around before too long.
Nice job.
Gently gliding with their hands held out to their sides. She then has them all scrape their skates away from each other sideways.
Just like this.
In what she calls a snow plow. It's pretty much 8-year-old Haley's favorite new move.
Because it's a good thing to know how to stop.
Stop more, maybe fall less.
Oh no!
Someday. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Helena.
The Helena Parks Department is holding these 30-minute ice skating classes at Memorial Park for the next 5 Tuesdays, starting at 6 p.m. As we told you last week, Montana's only breast milk bank has been screening, professionally testing, pasteurizing, and distributing human donor milk since early October of last year, and its executive co-director, Jessica Wellborn, says outreach efforts and interest is growing. The Mother's Milk Bank of Montana is the first regional milk bank to serve neonatal intensive care units and individual recipients in Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Wellborn explains how and why she and her co-executive director, Lindsay Wieseman, developed this project.
I actually came from California. I worked for many years for the Mother's Milk Bank of San Jose, and my now husband is from Missoula, and we lived here in the winter of 2012, and at that time, I connected with Lindsay, who is a registered nurse, but had a dream to open a milk bank here in Montana, largely due to the fact that she adopted a very malnourished baby from Ethiopia about 5 years ago now, and one, if not a few, mothers in the community actually offered their milk and shared their milk with her to help her baby, Disa, who really needed breast milk. So my boss in San Jose, the executive director of the milk bank there, had said, you know, if you're moving to Montana, do some research and see what would it take to get a milk bank up and running there, because Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, that's an area that is pretty underserved in terms of donor milk.
Why has it taken so long, do you think, here? Is it just our rural nature?
All the nonprofit milk banks in the United States operate under the same association called the Human Milk Bank Association of North America. So we follow really strict guidelines, really guidelines that are similar to blood banks. You know, and blood banks are everywhere throughout the state. Almost anyone is familiar with donating blood. Lots of people donate blood. I think there's a lot less awareness and understanding about donating breast milk, even though really we follow much of the same guidelines. And instead of blood, we collect breast milk, pasteurize it, and distribute it. So I think for years and years, whether it's Montana or California or Delaware, there's still a lot of work to be done to educate about donating milk and then to therefore establish more milk banks. I think that we are the 15th nonprofit milk bank in the United States, sort of all of North America, so that includes Canada. So I would say there's also sort of a large expense associated with establishing a milk bank. There used to be a lot more sort of smaller kitchen banks. We're not of women's homes, much smaller milk banks that really would just serve their local community. But in the early 80s, when it came out that HIV could pass through breast milk, and then a blood test was required by each donor, and the expense went up, a lot of those banks closed down, and it's been a really slow process to build them back up because there just are more resources needed to establish a nonprofit milk bank.
You know, we hear all the time about how breast milk is so nutritious. Why is it so good? Why is it better than, your average formula?
There are so many answers to that question. But, you know, breast milk has components to it, especially, you know, certain enzymes and antibodies that no matter how good the formula is, just not present in formula. Again, no matter how high quality the formula is, it's just breast milk is something that cannot be replicated. It builds a baby's immune system and prevents all kinds of illnesses that are just not possible with formula. I mean, formula has all kinds of good things in it, you know, all kinds of vitamins and really essential things for a baby, but there are just certain things, and I think especially when it comes to the antibodies and the enzymes that help fight illness and keep a baby really healthy through those first couple of years of life. Goat's milk or cow's milk is never going to have the same properties and benefits that human breast milk is going to have for a human baby.
So then who do these banks serve? Meaning under what circumstances can a woman not or at least have difficulty producing for her own baby?
Traditionally, milk banks, especially nonprofit milk banks, you know, one of the reasons they have such strict guidelines around donating and pasteurizing is that they serve hospital neonatal intensive care units. So a lot of this milk that we pasteurize or that the Mother's Milk Bank in San Jose pasteurizes or any other milk bank, and it's going to very premature and sick babies in the NICU who really benefit from that milk. And sometimes when a baby is born premature, mom is pumping her milk, you know, trying to get her milk supply up, but it's oftentimes harder to build up a milk supply when you've had a premature baby. So that's why neonatal intensive care units, more and more of them, are ordering and having a supply of donor milk on their unit because they, you know, see the benefits to a lot of those babies, and it buys that the mom time to build up her supplies. And then also we do have outpatient recipients of milk. So that would mean that a family would call and want to order donor milk for their baby. And families that adopt a baby and want donor milk over formula, they may call and order milk, and they do have to get a prescription from a doctor to order the milk. So we don't distribute without a prescription.
Oh, a prescription? How odd. Why?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's part of the Human Milk Bank Association North America guidelines that hospitals can order the milk and families can also order milk, but they do need a prescription from their doctor with a pretty basic information about the baby, the diagnosis, which it can be, you know, as simple as adoption or low milk supply, and the amount of ounces to distribute. So we distribute based on that prescription.
Is this a fee service or a nonprofit or what?
So the Mother's Milk Bank of Montana is a nonprofit organization. We do charge for the milk, and that's a processing fee that goes back into the operations of the milk bank. So we are not by any means profiting or a for-profit, but we do charge for the milk, which makes us a rare sort of nonprofit.
So then who are your donors? Who can and who cannot donate milk?
Let's say a mom wants to donate her milk, and typically that's a healthy mom with a healthy baby who has just extra milk, milk she knows that her baby won't use. And oftentimes we get calls from moms who have a freezer full of breast milk, and they know they're not going to use it, and they want to free up room in their freezer. So that's oftentimes, you know, once a mom has 100, 150 ounces, she calls us. Quickly, that process is they do a quick screening with us over the phone, you know, which really just asks basic demographic questions and a really sort of basic health questionnaire, things like, you know, are you on any medications, any history of blood transfusion or an organ tissue transplant, those sorts of things. And as long as they pass that screening, then we send them the longer application that they then fill out. And once we have that information back, then we do send each of our donors for a blood test. So they are required to get a blood test that tests for five specific things. And once we get a negative result on all of those, then they are cleared to donate their milk. Oftentimes what disqualifies a donor is medications. Mm-hmm. There are certain medications that are just fine. A lot of like allergy meds, women that are on thyroid medication, typically that's just fine. But then there are a list of medications that unfortunately do disqualify donors. So that's the biggest thing that we screen for.
Which meds are disqualifiers?
It really varies. Certain antidepressants, but certain antidepressants are also just fine. So, you know, we go off this really long list. If a mom is on antibiotics for any reason, she can't donate during that time she's taken the antibiotics. But let's say she's taking antibiotics for 7 days, then we have a 3-day waiting period. And then after that, she's able to donate. So there are certain medications or pain meds. Sometimes if a mom has had a C-section and she's on pain medication right after, we couldn't take any milk that she's pumped and saved then. But as long as there's that 3-day waiting period and she's not on any other meds that would disqualify her, then we can start taking her milk. So if it's, you know, certain medication that she's on daily that isn't okay, then that would disqualify her. And then there's certain medications that just temporarily disqualify a donor.
If I've missed this, I'm sorry, but is this then kind of also on the honor system? You're asking, and if they say no, I'm not on Prozac or fill in the blank. Do you just take their word? Or?
Yes. I mean, the blood test gives us a result for things like hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, those major chronic infections. But in terms of medications, you know, we obviously screen for drug use and smoking and all that, and that's all really truly is on the honor system.
How big is your distribution area, and what's the response been so far?
Our goal is to be the regional milk bank for Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, South Dakota, and North Dakota. Currently, I would say we are serving mostly Montana hospitals and individual recipients. We have shipped a bit of milk to individual recipients in North Dakota and have generated some interest in Idaho with hospitals that aren't currently using donor milk but that would like to in the future. So a lot of our work in the beginning of this year of 2014 is to really connect with those that are interested in using donor milk but that currently aren't.
And Ms. Wellborn, you said that you were involved in this issue in your time in California. What got you involved in the first place?
So I have a PhD in perinatal psychology, and initially I did my dissertation research at the Mother's Milk Bank in San Jose, and I actually interviewed about 20 bereaved mothers, women who lost a baby and then donated their milk after their loss. So it was really specific, you know, and again, to back up from there, as I said before, most women who donate their milk are healthy moms with healthy babies that just have extra milk. There is a small percentage of women, of bereaved mothers, who choose to donate their milk after losing a baby, and I was interested in that experience.
How sad and how beautiful a gift all at one time. Gee.
I think that sums it up in many ways. You know, I don't think there's anything that can make up for such a tragic experience as losing a baby. And I would say all the women that I interviewed donating their milk in some capacity helped them heal from their loss and also helped them connect with being a mother in some capacity when they couldn't be a mother to their own baby. And again, it by no means made up for their loss, but there is meaning and healing in that experience for them. Choosing to donate after losing a baby is not the right choice for every bereaved mother, but for some, it does help and provide healing.
My goodness. How can people find out more?
By either calling the Mother's Milk Bank of Montana office in Missoula. And I think also to say, and hope this doesn't complicate things too much, the Mother's Milk Bank of Montana is actually also housed with the Nursing Nook, which is both a lactation store and a place where women can get lactation help with breastfeeding. And so our goal in setting up with the Nursing Nook was to really be sort of like a one-stop shop for anything lactation related. So you can call the office at 406-531-6789 or email us at info@mothersmilkbankofmt.org.
And I've been speaking with Jessica Wellborn. I love the irony of your last name, of the
<Thank you. laughs>
Mother's Milk Bank of Montana. Jessica, thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Ed.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow with lows in the 20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 11 o'clock tonight for central Montana. There's also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for Hill, Cascade, Shodo, Blaine, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. That advisory is also in effect for elevations above 5,000 feet along the Rocky Mountain Front and in central and southern Lewis and Clark County. Tonight, watch for areas of snow and blowing snow with lows in the 20s. Wind gusts could reach up to 85 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 40 to 45 degrees. And in southwest Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect until 11 o'clock tonight for southwest Montana. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers and lows in the 20s. Wind gusts could reach up to 70 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The American Petroleum Institute gave a pep talk to the Montana Chamber of Commerce last week, urging the state of Montana to fully commit to the oil and gas energy boom that is sweeping the country. The American Petroleum Institute's chief economist asserted that the domestic oil and gas boom would foster, in a quote, an American renaissance of jobs and economic development that would produce thousands of jobs and millions of dollars in tax revenues, unquote. He directly took on the opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline that would move Alberta tar sands petroleum south across Montana and on to oil refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. Such opposition was just silly, he said, because those tar sands were going to be developed no matter what. For that reason, whatever environmental damage might be associated with that tar sands development will take place whether or not the Keystone XL pipeline is built. That argument should sound familiar. It's been used to belittle opposition to expanded coal development in the Powder River Basin, expanded natural gas production anywhere, and the building of coal ports on the West Coast. Apparently, pollution and greenhouse gas emissions will always be with us, no matter what our energy policy is. This fatalism, preached by energy companies, is useful to them, but hardly true. Alberta and its tar sand developers want the Keystone XL pipeline built through the U.S. to the Gulf Coast and its sister pipelines, the Northern Gateway pipelines across British Columbia, to a new oil port on BC's Pacific Coast, because they want to get paid the full world price for petroleum products rather than some lower domestic price tied to a regional oversupply. If the petroleum sludge from the tar sands can reach refineries on the coast or gain access to world refineries via gigantic ocean-going petroleum tankers, the tar sand developers will get a higher price for their product and earn higher profits. Absent cheap access to those international markets, the lower profit margins will discourage Alberta tar sands development. The energy companies know that. That is why natural gas producers, for instance, are also pushing for the liquefaction of American natural gas and the building of ports for the export of that LNG. Right now, from the natural gas producers' point of view, there is a glut of natural gas in the United States that has driven the price of natural gas downward. Natural gas companies are cutting back on exploration and development and shutting in their more expensive natural gas wells because of the low prices. That plentiful natural gas supply is currently landlocked in North America. If the natural gas companies can arrange to export it, they can sell it at a much higher price overseas. Of course, then all Americans and American businesses would also have to pay the higher world price for what is now cheap natural gas. It is not clear how higher energy prices to all Americans and American industries would trigger, quote, an American renaissance of jobs and economic development, unquote. This fatalistic refrain from energy developers is built around the proposition that the U.S. and the rest of the world are going to consume a certain amount of oil or natural gas or coal no matter what, because the national world economy simply have to have that energy. That is a strange position for any business or organization representing businesses to take. Do they not believe in supply and demand or prices and costs? Most business people pursue the most profitable markets and seek to keep their costs low for a reason. To argue that price and cost do not matter in the energy markets is ludicrous. Try telling that to the coal or nuclear or renewable energy industries as they have struggled to compete against low-priced natural gas. That change in relative fuel prices led to dramatic changes in how we generate electricity in the United States, a change with which coal companies are not particularly happy. Because natural gas is less carbon-intensive than coal, that fuel switching also was not carbon-neutral. At least if natural gas developers can control the gas leakage from gas development and transportation, that change from burning coal to burning natural gas will significantly reduce carbon emissions. If opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline is, as the American Petroleum Institute says, silly, there must be something in the water, air, and the Pacific Northwest infecting us all. British Columbia and its First Nations are also not happy with the proposed Northern Gateway pipelines that would carry tar sands products to a new export facility on the British Columbian Pacific Coast. Like many people in the United States, British Columbians are not happy either with that scheme to help the tar sands sludge reach world markets and are strongly opposing that purely Canadian pipeline project. Apparently, British Columbia, despite its strong commitment to natural resource development, has gotten infected with the same silliness disease as some Americans who oppose the Keystone XL pipeline. Of course, it is also possible that the American Petroleum Institute is simply wrong and that there may be some reasonable limit to the cost that the rest of us should be willing to pay to boost oil company profits.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.